Hey, it's Megan. Before we get to the episode, I want to tell you the latest about the Unspeakeasy and our retreats for this year. Our retreat in Seattle next month is pretty much full, but spots are available for several others this year, including our first ever co-ed retreat in Chicago, June 4th and 5th. That one will feature three guest speakers, legendary free speech champion and former ACLU president Nadine Strossen, who will be on the podcast very soon, Eric Smith, a professor of rhetorics and co-founder of Free Black Thought, who will be back on the podcast very soon, and journalist and author Lisa Selman Davis, who does extraordinary work on the new gender movement and who is the guest this week. You're about to hear her. For information about the Chicago retreat, as well as our retreats this fall in Toronto and in upstate New York, go to theunspeakeasy.com. Space is limited. That's the whole idea. These are small. So get in touch now.
I have a feminist defense of the trad wife movement. And I realize that there are some like serious conservatives in it. And I realize that there are some actual racists, and I'm not talking about them. But I'm talking about the women who were raised in the 90s in the girl power era. And they were watching Xena Warrior Princess. And they were like, I don't want that. I want to be a wife and a mom. And they were told that's not enough. And that's not feminist. And that's not, you know, that's not okay. And I think for some of them, it really makes them happy. And they want other women to know that you can do this.
Welcome to the Unspeakable Podcast. I'm your host, Megan Daum, or Daum. I was thinking I would just alternate every other week. Maybe I'll say Daum one week, Daum the next, or maybe that's just going to perpetuate this confusion. Anyway, all right, moving right along. My guest is making her third visit to the podcast, I believe. She is author and journalist Lisa Selman Davis. Lisa does some of the most thorough and, here's that word again, nuanced thinking and reporting about the subject of gender, and her previous visits have been about that subject. But she has a new book out about something completely, or at least mostly, different, the concept of the housewife. In Housewife, Why Women Still Do It and What to Do Instead, Lisa traces the social history of the housewife. She examines the roles of hunter-gatherer clans in prehistoric times and wrestles with why the iconic 50s housewife has such a strong hold on the public consciousness, despite not actually lasting very long past the 1950s. We also talk about something that has been fascinating me recently, the rise of the trad wife influencer. We do get into gender in the second part of the conversation. Her next book is about that. And if you're a paying subscriber, you will hear that part because you will hear the whole interview. If not, you're going to hear the preview portion only. To hear the rest, you know what to do. Join our paid listener community at megandaum.substack.com. And in the meantime, here's my conversation with Lisa Selman Davis. Lisa Selman Davis, welcome back to The Unspeakable.
Thank you so much, Megan, for having me.
I think you've been on two times, both times talking about gender, which is something that you've reported on a lot. And obviously, I think about a lot and talk about a lot. But now you're here to talk about something totally different. Your new book, Housewife, Why Women Still Do It All and What to Do Instead. And it's actually perfect because I think over the last few months, the only subject that interests me as much as the new gender movement is like the conversation around wifing and wifing up and this whole world of like trad wives. And even though I am not a wife anymore, it's a fascinating topic that I feel like has recently become more fascinating. So it's perfect that you're here. So thank you. Why did you want to write this book?
Well, the origin story of this book is it's going to start out with something that is embarrassingly bland, which is that I had a baby in 2009. Oh, that was not a bland experience, but I joined a mom's group and I'm not a joiner type. I did not belong to any clubs or groups in high school or play any sports. I just smoked pot and went to the art room and drew. So this was kind of my first group experience, and it was a very positive experience in a whole lot of ways. But there was one woman in the group who referred to herself as a housewife until she got married, and then she was a stay-at-home mom. And I don't know where this woman came from or what happened to her. She made a brief appearance, and I just thought that was very odd because I didn't even know that was an option. And I had written a book before about, you know, called Tomboy, and that was a word that nobody used anymore, and yet all of the thoughts behind that word were with us and contested and in all kinds of ways without using it anymore. And I felt the same way about a housewife. But I wasn't thinking about it again until 2020. And Trump started tweeting things like, the suburban housewife will vote for me. And suburban housewives, Biden's going to ruin your neighborhoods. And when I looked into it, you know, the demographics of suburbia had changed so much that the person most likely to be a housewife was a poor woman, immigrant, usually a woman of color. So then I went down a housewife rabbit hole. And, you know, it's still about gender. It's just about the kind of gender that I was studying in college and raised with, which was when gender meant our expectations of someone based on sex. It's just not about gender as it's used now, which is a deeply felt sense of self.
I feel like in my memory, the kind of demonization, or at least the kind of negative valence on the housewife, started with Betty Friedan in the feminine mystique. I feel like as of the late 60s into the 70s, it was really like uncool to be a housewife. But was it the feminine mystique that kind of started this? And that would have been in the early 60s, I guess.
Well, one of the things I really found interesting was how that word was understood in different eras. And I have a chapter on these radical working class ethnic housewives of the 30s who were striking and sometimes even violent for people who crossed the picket line during the Depression. And they were mostly there were these meat strikes against butcher shops and saying that the prices were artificially inflated. And they were wielding that word in this particular way to make them seem kind of, let's say, upstanding. And, you know, they were drawing on this ideal. And, you know, by the next decade, they're saying that housewives who were unfit for work outside the home are suddenly perfectly fit for work outside their home because the men have gone off to war. And so their nimble fingers that they used for, you know, crocheting and embroidery were perfect for factory work.
Okay, so this is the Rosie the Riveter age you're talking about. This is during World War II.
During World War II, but they're redefining the housewife to fit whatever they need it to be. And then in the 50s, it's now you are actually you have to go back. Not only do you have to go back to the domestic domain, but we're going to reorder the way we live in terms of separating the domestic and the commercial by way of suburbia, where you're also going to be sequestered, which I think in some places they were calling it this like suburban illness. So what she calls the problem with no name, which is we got a lot of education and now we're bored.
Right. This is Friedan, by the way, Betty Friedan. The feminine mystique was, you know, had to do with this. The central motif was what she called the problem that has no name.
Yeah, so I guess the bottom line is housewife referred to whoever, look, I'm sorry to say it this way, but whoever men needed it to refer to. And women could try to grab onto it to either to elevate themselves or to paint themselves as upstanding in some way. And many, many times it was used to put them down and just, you know, just a housewife as the ultimate insult for women. So it's a more flexible word than I thought before I did all this research.
Okay. And when we say they, I know this comes up all the time, but like for the purposes of this interview, when you say they, I'm assuming that you're talking about kind of a combination of like messaging from some kind of central government office and advertisers, right? So there's, yeah, you know, advertisers and marketers, but there's also, I'm assuming, messaging that's coming from political leaders, like, you know, the way that people in government leadership roles are talking about their constituency. This is sort of how they're organizing it in their minds. And then of course this trickles down into advertising and marketing and that kind of thing.
Yeah, there's a lot of overlap in these different eras. So obviously we've all seen, you know, the famous Rosie the Riveter, We Can Do It. There are also a whole bunch of ads saying, housewives, gather up your bacon fat to make bombs. And in the 30s, there were campaigns to, you know, if only one person in your household could get a job, you know, make sure the man gets the job, or there are the kind of, you know, pink jobs that it's okay for women to have. And when there were layoffs, for instance, in government jobs during the Depression, they would make sure that if a man and woman in a family were both employed, that the woman would get sacked first. So yeah, I think there have always been campaigns that, you know, the ideas sometimes come centralized from the government, and they get taken up by the culture to sell things. So they can be taken up by women's magazines that can be enlisted to reinforce these ideas. And in fact, there are some amazing articles, you know, in women's magazines that are in the 60s and 70s, you know, telling them to stay in their lane. And so, yeah, it all gets mixed together.
Okay, so one of the assumptions that I have, and I think others do too, is that before the Industrial Revolution, all of this was sort of moot because we were, you know, largely an agrarian society. Everybody was working, whether it was on the farm or elsewhere. It was all hands on deck. Even if there was a kind of, you know, gender divide in terms of division of labor, everybody was working, so there was no such thing as a housewife. So how accurate is that?
Well, it depends, rural and urban. And they might be different jobs, but there certainly were rural housewives. But, you know, they did a lot of work. And if they were wealthy enough, they were managing a staff, but they were still doing a lot of labor. And, you know, there's not a leisure class yet. And one of the things that I thought was interesting was learning about Republican motherhood in the 16th and 17th century. And that is an approach to the family in which the father is the stern center and the mother is very much off to the side. And there's an idea, which will come up over and over again, that if the mother is too prominent, too coddling, too affectionate, that your sons essentially will be sissies. and so the father really takes over. And obviously that changes as generations go by and women become more and more prominent within their families. And it changes during the 19th century when there's the cult of domesticity and the kind of like, we've got to keep women in the home and they've got to be submissive and domestic. And that actually increases the role of the mother within the family and also ups the anxiety about what's going to happen when a mom pays too much attention. But there are so many different kinds, from the beginning of the founding of America, there are so many different kinds of families, and they are arranged so differently depending on where they are and what we need from them, and you know, where we need people to move. And I guess by we, I mean I didn't say they, but I said we, you know, getting people to move west for the railroad or having people go out west for the gold rush. You know, the family dynamics change. They're so related, I think, from the beginning of human history to the environment, much more than I ever would have imagined.
Right. And one of the most interesting moments in your book, in the first half anyway, was when you talk about how, I guess it was in the 1600s and 1700s, the average marriage only lasted like 10 years because somebody would die. Right?
Yeah.
And so many of the children died. And I, as you're talking, I'm thinking like this idea that the man is sort of the moral center of the family. Now I'm really just like thinking out loud here. I wonder if that had to do with a kind of longer psychic leash, or that somehow men would be inherently less emotional and would be less attached to the children, less attached to family members, because you know you're going to have tragedy. You know that a certain amount of them are going to die. And I wonder if there was some kind of like unconscious, you know, if you keep the women, you know, far enough away from it emotionally, there will be less emotional pain when inevitably somebody or many people die prematurely.
Well, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about
you're
it
welcome.
Like that.
Sorry.
Yeah, thank you. I'm going to rewrite the book now.
You really need to rethink this whole book. Yeah.
This is what I think. First of all, I doubt there was as much focus on emotional pain, but also I think that there were so many community institutions. I think people were more involved in communities, and I think there were, you know, everyone belonged to a church, and in early American societies, there were, again, depending on where you were, you know, there were more civic and community institutions, especially as different parts of America got settled. And so I think you live a more communal life, and I'm not going to romanticize it. I'm just, a lot of this book is about remembering that humans, you know, are pack animals, and that we moved into this nuclear model of a family very, very recently, and that it put a disproportionate amount of pressure on women. So I wasn't alive then. It seems like a hard time to be alive before electricity and doing a lot of manual labor, which I would not enjoy. But I do think that because you could not rely entirely on just a husband and wife at the center of a family, because the maternal mortality rate is high, the infant mortality rate is high, and you know that you're going to need other people to help the project of your family or your farm or your business. And so I think you have to not invest so heavily just in one person. That's my assumption. And it's also my assumption that that is as important as it is to have, you know, a strong family. And we have all this evidence right now about kids do better in these two-parent families, et cetera. I often think, well, there's more, tends to be more money in those families and more security. We can't all have those families. But I also think, well, I always wanted my kids to feel like there were lots of adults around that were also their family, whether they officially were or not. That I had this sense before I wrote this book that if I could replicate the clan in some way, I mean, I didn't put it to myself like that, but I just knew that the best time of my own childhood before my parents got divorced was when we lived in a super hippie, we didn't live in a commune. There were just a lot of hippie folk musicians around. My parents had deliberately moved to a town that had a big folk scene, and my dad was a musician, and it was so wonderful to, even though the adults were stoned out of their minds, and the kids were running around, you know, with no one watching us, it's still, I think it felt like the clan. And those are my happiest memories. And I wanted my kids, without the drugs and divorce, I wanted my kids to have that experience.
You talk in the book about just feeling, you know, you have your first child, you have your older daughter, and you talk about feeling like a failure in large part because your apartment is messy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, look, it was not messy in my mom's house growing up. And it's not like she had a cleaning lady. We had nothing. We had no money. And anytime somebody got money, by the way, I stole it. Like if my brother got money from someone or She had this woman who, this lovely woman who was sort of like a mother to her, and she'd send us $5 bills a couple times a year. I would just steal his because I desperately, desperately wanted to have new clothes. And I will say it was a big deal when those John Hughes movies came out. And
oh, because you could wear vintage. You could go to the Goodwill and dress like Molly
Ringwald. Yeah, because
going
to Salvation Army was cool instead of, please God, don't let anybody see me in here. When I was in seventh grade, my mom remarried a college professor, and we achieved, perfect middle-class status, not wealth of any kind, but nothing terribly embarrassing anymore. But I wasn't, he didn't share his money with us. And it's not like it was that high paying a job, but it was better anyway. Like that kind of constant money freak out wasn't quite there. So, Yeah.
So you have your first daughter, you're in this mom's group. I mean, what kinds of things are you seeing around you? I mean, you talk about being in Brooklyn, you're in the parts of Brooklyn where everybody, they live in Manhattan. And then as soon as they get a positive pregnancy test, they move to these neighborhoods in Brooklyn where there are good public schools. There's a couple of good public schools.
Whatever that means.
Everyone's crowded into these neighborhoods.
Right.
So, I mean, it is really something to behold. And I mean, we talk about this, just the incredible bar that I think women have set for themselves. Mm. Like, you have to be like this girl boss, and you have to be like incredibly physically attractive and physically fit and have these perfect children and have a perfect home. And, it's like, as we've talked about many times, part of the unforeseen consequences of the women's movement was it's not like it just sort of, freed women to do all this other stuff. It added on a bunch of stuff.
Yeah. So what happened when I finally did join this group, that I was disdainful of and jealous of is that I found it to be very welcoming and very helpful, and the women to be very nice. And a lot of women that I was afraid of because they were normal. And I had just been surrounded. I have always been surrounded by weirdos. But they were accepting of me, and it was helpful, but I felt incredibly incompetent. And even things, I'd grown up where my mom had taught me to knit, not like she knits, but I could knit perfectly fine. I'm not good at following directions. So I could knit hats when I just invented them myself. But a lot of these women had careers. And then if they were staying home or taking some time off, they got really good at all that stuff. It was almost competitive that you're doing, you're making your homemade pickles or whatever, but they're totally perfect. And I just wasn't, I've never been like that.
Right. Well, they were bringing their professional ambition. They were channeling it into this, right?
Exactly. I mean,
they decided not to go for law partner. So they're going to do this.
Right. Right. So they're going to win the pie contest. And yeah, so I felt I felt really, really incompetent. And my husband was very busy at work. And I had a baby just as the economy tanked. And as you know, the whole magazine industry imploded. And, I was off writing articles about new green retirement communities in Mexico and getting paid like $5,000 for it and taking a long time and thinking hard about, just how the contradictions inherent in such a project. But thinking about green building and thinking about the architecture of community, which had been my original obsession. And it went from that to, from $5,000 to $150 for a hot take on something that was very shallow. And at the same time, in order to do that, I had to pay somebody else $20 an hour.
And I just take care of your child.
Yeah. To watch my child. And I could not make sense of the math or even like the kind of emotional math. Like how much is it good for me to be alone with my child? How much is it good for my child to be ignored? Because actually, there were a lot of things that I realized now thanks to the emerging discourse about like coddling and overparenting that I realized I did wrong. And I think I was worried about the wrong things. And I also think I was really, really surrounded by wealth. And I had never, I mean, I'd gone to college where my mom worked as a librarian. So there were wealthy people there, but the culture was that you didn't display your wealth really, you know? So this was, it was all new and confusing for me, much more confusing than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah. Well, I want to get into something that I know you know I'm interested in, which is the emergence of this trad, that's short for traditional culture. We now have trad wife influencers, just this idea that you can go back to the land, this kind of permaculture from a branding perspective. This is really resonating with a lot of people. Mm. You know, I think there's one in particular called Ballerina Farms. I don't know if that's the name of their estate. I don't actually follow these people personally, you know, but you've got like this woman, I think she's got like 6 kids or, you know, some large number, and they've all been home births, and she looks amazing, and she does, you know, they're farming the land and she's canning. I mean, it is completely Instagram. It's everything is for the gram. Let's just put it that way. And so I wonder what you make of that. What do you think is going on with this obsession?
I have a feminist defense of the trad wife movement. And I realize that there are some like serious conservatives in it. And I realize that there are some actual racists, and I'm not talking about them, but I'm talking about the women who were raised in the 90s in the girl power era. And they were watching Xena Warrior Princess, and they were like, I don't want that. I want to be a wife and a mom. And they were told that's not enough. And that's not feminist. And that's not, you know, that's not okay. And I think for some of them, it really makes them happy. And they want other women to know that you can do this. So I think that's partially where it comes from, that the only way to be that in this society really has been to be, you know, either some part of a conservative Christian movement, and a lot of them are conservative Christians, but not all, or to be in these kind of urban educated communities where you grapple with all of these different feelings of, well, you grapple mostly with shame that you've given up a career or that all you're doing is raising your children. And just going back to that idea of Republican motherhood, you know, that meant the project of the family and the mother was to raise good citizens. It was your patriotic duty. I don't think that's a bad thing. I actually think what we're really talking about is, what do we need to do to raise functional children? Because it seems like we've been raising children who are having trouble functioning in the most basic way at a time when these kids have.
That was a taste of my interview with journalist Lisa Sellen Davis, author of the new book, Housewife: Why Women Still Do It and What to Do Instead. Lisa also writes a Substack, Broadview, about matters related to the new gender movement. It's terrific, so you should check it out. The rest of this conversation is also terrific, and you can hear it by going to my Substack, megandom.substack.com, or The Unspeakable with Megan Dom, and becoming a paying subscriber. I'll be back next week with another super nuanced guest. Thanks for listening. See you then.